Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. Today's episode is a banger. One of those incendiary conversations that just kind of feels dangerous. That makes you want to kind of hide somewhere where no one's going to see how you react to it. Whether you laugh, whether you gasp, whether you start to have revelations about a completely different food system. Elaine Power is the kind of intellectual that not only does Canada produce, but we sure need a whole lot more from. Or at least we need to listen to a whole lot more from. And Elaine is kind of the person who, quite frankly, reinvigorates my desire to use this podcast as a platform for provocation, as a platform for thoughtful policy, as we kind of allude to at the conclusion of our conversation, but also to really encourage people to think about food and our relationship to food in an entirely new manner. Now, full disclosure, I recorded this conversation in May and then sat on it for a while, in part because it is so radical. It is so refreshing. It is, if anything, kind of dangerous to the status quo. And I wanted to make sure that we had a certain amount of political and policy diversity in the can, kind of in our knowledge base, before we lit fire to it all by chatting with Elaine. Now, granted, I am hyping up this conversation in hopes that you are excited to listen to it. This is where I will remind you that if this isn't the first time you've listened to this podcast, go and give us a rating somewhere, anywhere, that other people might be able to access the episodes we're putting together. It certainly helps give us feedback, but more importantly, it helps give the knowledge and the conversations that we're producing some traction. Because that's really the moral responsibility I felt after having this conversation with Elaine. That on the one hand, we face some really challenging and difficult times ahead. But on the other hand, there is a range of policy ideas, cultural ideas, solutions that would really transform society and our food in a way that is truly revolutionary. So enough hype. Let's get into the episode. Without any further ado, here's Elaine Power. Elaine, welcome to the Future Herd.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, I've kind of worked up a ritual where the first question is meant to be a kind of intuitive, almost Rorschach test. What does the future mean to you?
Oh, my gosh. The future.
It's a loaded word. What can I say?
It is, Jesse. I'm kind of worried about our future. I have to say, no matter which way you turn, it feels pretty messed up. So I'm worried about democracy. I'm worried about the food system. I'm worried about the climate crisis. I'm worried about the food system. It's all kind of messed up. I have a 19-year-old, and of course I teach young people. I was teaching this past term, I was teaching a course on the food system. And I had to work really hard not to just really burden them completely, like kind of, you know, all in that all encompassing sense of doom and dread and despair, because the dominant agro-industrial food system is totally messed up. I'll refrain from using profanity, but
you may.
Know, it really is.
This is the benefit of podcasts is we can fucking swear. There's privileges okay. There.
Well, the food system is really fucked up. It's really fucked up, no matter which way you turn. So yeah. So
right on.
So the young people I taught this year, they seemed inspired by my passion for the subject, and they also seemed to get that I cared about them as people in this messed up system. But one day after class, one of the very bright young women came up to me and said, "How do you stay optimistic? No, how do you stay hopeful?" And I refrained from saying, "Well, I'm not very hopeful," and then proceeded to talk about, watching the birds in my backyard, as a way to maintain my sense of stability and groundedness in the world. Every week in the class, I would do a section, that I called "In the News" about things that were happening that week, generally, in the news about that had some relation to the food system. It's very depressing. And so after she asked that question, the next week, it was March, and the next week I put up pictures of, the robins and the crocuses. Like, this is really the only way to stay, for me anyway, to stay from descending into total despair.
And there is a kind of paradox between, on the one hand, I think a growing sense that our food system is at risk, that our global climate system is at risk. I'm personally feeling 2026 may be a breaking point on a number of different fronts. And yet, every day I'm eating food that gives me pleasure. And every day I'm learning more about food that makes me feel more human and makes me even feel healthier as I age, which was a paradox I had not anticipated and certainly welcome. While I do try to focus our conversations here on the podcast on kind of the present and the future, I do feel a little bit of kind of responsibility to my audience to spend a little bit at the beginning, not so much on origin story, but getting a sense of where the guests' perspectives come from. And in your case, you've had a really interesting dance between your political interests and your research interests, where they are clearly reinforcing each other, but you're not necessarily the kind of academic or politically engaged person who has focused on a specific issue and stuck with that issue. It's guided your journey. And I say that because you could have ended up anywhere, championing any policy or fighting any tyranny. But the causes and the issues you've chosen kind of speak to maybe not a logic, maybe a method. I don't know. I'm curious, if only because in sort of learning more about your background, I was blown away. I was like, wow, that seems like you had a really fun time, even though, to your point, you're dealing with issues that are kind of depressing and kind of difficult on an empathic level to wrap your head around. I'm doing what I do, which is ramble. Elaine, help me out here. How did you get to where you are now? Was it entirely accidental, or were there some driving principles along the way?
I think, I'm from the East Coast. I grew up in Nova Scotia, and I feel like the wind blew me here. I don't It's funny you should say that, this, because I'm just working on a paper right now that has a revise and resubmit, and I'm kind of rethinking the literature review and thinking, if only I had specialized a little more. But it's not in my nature. I'm one of those people who likes to see the like to make the connections among the bigger the in the big picture. And so the book that got me interested in food and food systems was Francis Moore LePage's Diet for a Lonely Planet, or yes, no, Diet for what's it called? Diet for a Hungry Planet, not Lonely Planet. That's the travel people. Diet for a Hungry Planet. Which I read as an undergraduate, which is a long time ago now, and I got really interested in the politics of food because of that book and the idea that we had lots of food, and we needed, to figure out how to distribute it better, and the idea that we didn't need, meat necessarily to have a healthy diet and to have enough protein. And that kind of set me on a journey that is long and rambly. And as I say, I think the wind kind of blew me here. But I don't know if that answers your question, but thank you. It's kind of reassuring, especially today, to think that to think about the pieces that all came together to put me here, which honestly sometimes feels like a cosmic joke.
Well, it does set up a natural follow-up, which is why do you think that food, both as an area of research, but also as an area of practice, whether formally or informally, professionally or personally, why do you think it lends itself to generalists? Because as you were describing that, I was thinking not just of the people I've interviewed as part of this podcast, but the people I've admired and I've enjoyed. That they were, for the most part, people who were interested in a lot of stuff. And they used those interests as ingredients to make themselves and the food or art or research that they create even greater. So I'm curious, given, the time you spent in these circles, whether you agree, whether you think that this is an area in which generalists are kind of not only encouraged to thrive, do thrive.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you know, I think food is fascinating, and it can lead you in so many directions. I mean, from the very personal, it's something we all need every day, several times a day. It's biological, it's physical, it's cultural, it's symbolic, it can take you in so many different directions, into history, into art, into food systems, into the big picture, the small picture. I don't know. There's nothing really quite like it. I mean, and it's a source of pleasure, kind of delight. So from the very small, I did spend a few years as a dietitian, so kind of thinking about nutrients, and from all the way through to the climate crisis and global issues, and in the news, the Strait of Hormuz, the war that's going on right now, that's going to have a huge that people are going to die. Because food prices are going to go up, and they won't be able to afford the food that they eat. So it feels like something that connects both in both directions, from the very minutia to the global. And there, like I say, there's delight and despair at the same moment in food, from my perspective.
Well, and again, you're sort of helping me understand my own interests, my own appeal to here. And I think it is because food allows us to connect the dots. It allows us to see how politics and economics and culture and family and our sense of being all kind of relate to each other, how these systems all impact each other. So still on the big picture piece, I kind of inherited the word agri-food when I started this podcast, in that it was not necessarily something I thought about. It was just a word I heard other people use, and it by default part of the framing of the episode of the podcast. And you were one of the first person to kind of poke at that word when I started communicating with you, and got me thinking about where it came from and the role that it serves. And to phrase this in the form of a kind of question or observation, it strikes me that there's a real contradiction in the phrase agri-food. And as I unpack it, it kind of feels that the agri side is really kind of right wing in its view of the world, and the food side is really kind of left wing in terms of its view of the world. I'm not sure how conscious this kind of setup is, whether it's like deliberately evoking the French National Assembly or whatever. Am I wrong in sensing this kind of political polarization or political balance that has been created?
Wow, that I've never thought of that, Jesse. I think it might be a really it might be kind of illuminating. Certainly agro or agri, we have agri food. tends to, for sure, represent, I think, corporate interests. There's another little part of me that says that the people I know who are part of the National Farmers Union would object to that, because of course there are also the small and medium-sized farmers, which probably you're one. Yeah, I think you might be onto something there, because the corporate, the corporate side of things is really, well, capitalism in general, I think, turns things of value upside down. So that, and in the food system, the corporate food companies, those big multinationals, are really all about creating, I think it was Tony Winston who said they're like create pseudo foods, because that's how they make money. They take cheap ingredients and they turn it into something that they call food, but really, certainly in terms of ultra processed foods, are just a vehicle for making money. And they might have some calories in them, but are really very, they don't sustain life, and they're very destructive for the planet and for the natural world. So yeah, I think you might be onto something there.
Well, and I say this only because I am trying to understand these systems and the different dynamics in them. And I have always been alienated from the agricultural side in that I don't feel that they are including either the voices or the analysis or even, quite frankly, the data to understand the sector they're in. And a key point that you often bring up that I wouldn't mind kind of unpacking for people, because it strikes me as both self-evident but also ignored, is the extent to which labor in our food system is either unrecognized or radically undervalued. And I think farmers understand this. Farmers very much feel that their labor is undervalued largely. But I'd love to hear your kind of insight or understanding of this, because I suspect that it, to your point, really emphasizes the values that we come to the agri-food or the food system with.
I'm just repeatedly struck by the labor that's invisible and or undervalued. If you think from the farm, if you think about bigger, more corporate farms that are employing in Canada, temporary foreign workers or undocumented workers, laborers who's they're doing back breaking work that is totally undervalued. They're feeding us, and yet, and that which is the basis of life for humanity, and yet we treat them poorly. We don't we they're invisible. Their wages are low. They have long hours. We send them home when we don't need them anymore. With disruption of family ties and all kinds of dysfunctional relationships because they're traveling back and forth all the time. So from there to the supermarket where we gave workers heroes pay during the pandemic for a few months and then went back to minimum wages, broken shifts, not to full-time work, low rates of unionization and benefits and all the rest, to the domestic kitchen where and the thing about food is that it's actually it's a lot of work. And so it seems like those who are able to want to shuffle it off onto other people. The second wave feminists in the 60s and 70s wanted nothing to do with the kitchen because it is undervalued and because it is invisible, and it's so much work. And so the big corporate agro man, food man, quote unquote food manufacturers, started with TV dinners, but have capitalized on, like, literally on this, the work and the undervaluing of food. So in a way, it's like, Yeah. So I think those of us in who are food scholars who also think of ourselves as feminists, you know, have had to work at bringing that trying to point out that this work is fundamental to human life, and it needs to be more valued than it is. So I don't. I think because it's been women who are, you know, at least in the domestic sphere. I think, you know, in the agricultural sphere, they're often racialized. You know, we think, you know, I think about, especially in the U.S., with, you know, that it was Black people, slaves, who labored in the fields. And it's still, you know, mostly racialized people in the fields, whether it's in the US or in Canada. You know, I think I don't I you know, as you were speaking, I thought about France, where you know, there is certainly more emphasis put on on cultural aspects of food, but I think their food system is also still very much based on exploitation of labor and the environment. I was just reading a piece in The Guardian this morning about massive seaweed blooms off the coast of France that from agricultural runoff, fertilizers and manure, that it, you know, it's literally killing people who step on these, you know, up to 5 feet deep piles of seaweed, and it's releasing hydrogen sulfide and like literally killing people. And you know, undoubtedly also killing fish and you know, wildlife and so on. So back to the original, you know, this is really depressing. It's really dark, but yes, I think the, you know, I don't know what it will take to re if we were able to revalue food and the like real food and the labor that produces it, I think we would transform the world, because it's so much at the heart of life.
And as an aside, when you were at the beginning talking about your students' often reaction to you, and what I was hearing in your observation was that on some level, in spite of your best efforts to help these students understand the horrors that await them, you are nonetheless inspiring them. And I think that inspiration partly comes from acknowledging what everyone is seeing, but hardly anyone is willing to talk about. And I think you did that just there, and I want to unpack a little because you sort of alluded to something that I'm kind of passionate about myself, which is the curse of convenience. That, you know, we've been sold this myth that, you know, convenience is good, whether it comes to our food, whether it comes to our social interactions, in my case, whether it comes to our technology. When, you know, there's value in making a healthy meal, especially with others, right? And making that meal and sharing that labor and eating that food, there's community building there. There's a social ritual there. So I'm curious, and you kind of alluded to this, but I'm curious on a political level, both on the plane of community, but also higher when we think about society, how do we counter that culture of convenience? How do we get people not just to value other people's labor when it comes to making food, which is essential, and to your point, it's not just agricultural labor that remains racialized. I mean, restaurant labor, right? Kitchens are also very racialized. So while on the one hand, yes, we do need to be valuing the labor of the people who produce food, I also think, correct me if I'm wrong, we need to be valuing our own labor, like thinking that it is worth us spending time to make a healthy meal for us and our family. A lot of people don't even aren't even there, and that's one of the reasons why they're so seduced by this myth of convenience.
For sure. I mean, when you talked about community building, you know, making food for oneself and others, I think it's an expression of love. It's and yeah, so sorry, I lost the question, but you probably know I'm an advocate for basic income. And one of the things that I think basic income might be able to help us with is rethinking how we spend our time. Because right now, as you know, we're all having to scramble to make enough money to put a roof over our head and food on the table. And some most of us, it's kind of a chicken and egg, isn't it? Because I think about how people are really scrambling to like say do that work, but also raise a family potentially, or to be involved in other activities. And we're so time crunched. I mean, maybe it's a product of well, I was going to say maybe it's a product of the choices we make, but choice is kind of is such a loaded word. I think we have very limited choice actually. And so, in a way, I think basic income would open up some space potentially for us to make other choices and for people to rethink their relationship to food in particular, that they could rethink how they get their food and how much of their own food they want to grow. And to give us some breathing space. I mean, in a way, capitalism kind of depends on us not having that breathing space, so that we are buying those convenience foods and like buying instead of taking time. So, there's a real, obviously there's kind of a, such a relationship between time and money, inverse relationship. So those of us who have some money don't have the time, and those of who have time don't have money. So anyway, it's messed up, but absolutely, I think we have been sold this bill of convenience that, of course, we all want to work less, and then we forget about the joy, the joy, also the like the pain of that work, of producing our own food, of but I honestly, to me, there's nothing like, it could be very simple food, but if it's homemade, it has a different quality. It's like the food that you grow yourself that tastes nothing like what you get in the grocery store. So there's that we it, the convenience glosses over the delight, the joy, the pleasures of other aspects of the food, particularly the taste, but also that joy and pleasure of sharing the food, of the love that comes with that,
I kind of feel that we're evoking a larger culture of food. And on the one hand, we've already critiqued the kind of corporate culture of food. At least we've, hit some of the edges around that. And, to go back to my point about this juxtaposition between the politics of the agri side and the politics of the food side, I'm curious to what extent, again, also circling back to our generalist idea, food studies as a larger kind of a culture, as a larger kind of discourse of researchers, of activists, of eaters, of, people who want to make food more accessible. What role does culture play within that work? And I say this and playing on words, that I always find it funny that the word agriculture relies upon culture. And of course, that culture means lots of different things, from fermentation to, how farmers do things. But the food side has a culture to itself that I think you're describing when you talk about affection, when we talk about community, when we talk about valuing the labor that goes into these things. Is there a meta consciousness within food studies around culture and psychology of food? I mean, there certainly is around health and around nutrition and around policies. Are there people, elaborating and doing research around some of the concepts that we're currently unearthing and throwing around?
Yeah, I think so. I think some, you mentioned two other people that you've had on your podcast, and I would say both of them have, an awareness of cultural issues. Yeah, I think sometimes it gets buried in other, I think each of us comes to food studies with our own preoccupations and bugaboos, and whether that's sustainability, the environment, and so on. So I think it is, in a way, maybe the substrate underneath a lot of what happens, maybe again, kind of maybe taken for granted somewhat, more than others. But yeah, sorry, I think I've lost your question again.
You're not losing anything. We are quite joyously discussing very scary and at the same time inspiring topics at the same time, which kind of leads me to a
Yeah.
follow-up. In speaking with Alyssa and speaking with Charles and speaking with yourself, feeling a sense of revolution. That within food studies, there is a kind of revolutionary ethos, which, to go to our earlier point, is a consequence of using food to connect the dots and see the polycrisis that is threatening all aspects of our lives. Is food studies explicitly revolutionary, or are there just a lot of revolutionaries in food studies?
That's such a great question. I think many of us identify with a critical food studies that is deliberately attentive to issues of power, and whether that's issues of gender, of race, of class, of inequality, of wealth, of the corporate kind of power. I don't know that food studies is inherently revolutionary, but it really, you're right, it does attract a lot of people who, you don't have to go too far in thinking about food to realize, it really exemplifies and reproduces a lot of the systems of inequality that structure the world. So, yeah, so I would say more that, there are more or less there, obviously there are people in food studies who are not particularly revolutionary. I think in Canada, especially, the food studies community really has always had an emphasis on thinking, imagining a more just world, and thinking about that through food and through the food system.
And is that also true globally? Because certainly, from my own biased view, it does seem that when people focus on food, let's say outside of the agricultural industry, it does also lend itself to, hey, our current systems are inadequate. We need to overthrow them and/or replace them in order to sustainably feed people in a socially just manner.
I think it depends how you probably depends how you define the boundaries of food studies. Because my work kind of crosses into, critique of food charity in particular, and kind of some anti-poverty work. I think that there's actually lots of people who publish in lots of food scholars who or publish in food studies journals who I think would be happy to tinker around the edges and make things a little bit better, but without a revolutionary or more radical kind of agenda, I would say. Yeah.
Well, and let's unpack some of that, criticisms of food charity. And I say this because I'm certainly familiar with the concept that charity is an obstacle to justice. But the fact that I just said those words means that there are people listening right now who are like, "What the fuck?" So I'd love for you to share your own thoughts on the limits or problems with our current charity approach to addressing hunger.
How long do we have?
We got time.
Okay, so food charity, specifically food banks, which are relatively new in Canada. The first one opened in Edmonton in 1981, and that's within my lifetime. It's a while ago, but It was a direct import from the United States. It's very clear that there was a food bank in Arizona that set up in the 60s. That was and food banks at the origins of food banks were about redistributing food waste. And the US is very much characterized by this idea that if you have hungry people, you give them food. And their food their I mean the SNAP, the current iteration of food stamps is different than that, but it's in its origins it was meant to help people, connect them with food surplus. And food banks originally were also about this idea that food was going to waste, horror, and they're hungry people, so you want to connect them. It I don't think it's a coincidence that that happened at the same time that, neoliberal political philosophy was taking root, with the, shrinking of the state and the undermining of social assistance and employment insurance. And so it's a perfect fit for a neoliberal kind of political ideology. You hand off responsibility for what used to be state responsibilities, including income, to the private sector, to the charitable sector, to community organizations. They just took root and proliferated because there's a kind of common sense about it. It's like, well, people are hungry, and it's also people are hungry, so we give them food. And I mean, I think most Canadians, those of us who have money or have the ability to feed ourselves, it seems hard to imagine that there are people who are food insecure in a country that's so wealthy and so rich, where so much food is going to waste. So there's also something, we were talking about, eating together as part of, this community building and a sense of belonging and dignity and love. And so I think it's very, very satisfying personally to imagine that you could do something that would alleviate someone's hunger. But then food banks have also taken on all kinds of other, functions in our society. So, we have food drives that are team building exercises or competitions at work, or it's a way to show that you're, quote unquote, good citizen because you bring a non-perishable food item to the football game, or, you drop some things in the bin at the grocery store. And then, it's also now more recently, a place to again to alleviate food waste, so we're not sending food to the landfill, and so we get to be good citizens and we get to be good green citizens. So they serve all these other functions, and I think that the needs of people who are food insecure are completely lost in those in that. So we know from survey research that probably about a quarter of the people in the country who are food insecure ever go to a food bank. And food banks are limited by their donation, what they have available, by their donations, by their labor pool. They have limited hours. They have to close the doors when they run out of food. There's just so many problems, and so it's serving all these other functions for other groups in society, but the needs of people who actually use them, that's not one of that. Those are completely overlooked and forgotten. And I guess that's classic in a way that history is written by the victors, and food banks are run by those who already have, as a way to, that I in a way it kind of takes the pressure off. We don't have people marching in the street. We don't have food riots because we have food banks. Not yet. Yeah. And there's a way in which it locks the status quo into place. So when I think about the like thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of volunteer hours that are soaked up in food banks, and nobody wants to see people go hungry. But the reality is that lots of people go hungry in this country or are worried about going hungry. Anyway, if I think about all those hours, like imagine what else we could be doing with with those hours and with that time. I mean, there are lots of other things. There's lots of other work and lots of other, labor, or maybe people would be out learning how to play the guitar or writing poetry or growing your own
And
food. I don't know.
on the one hand, I do think that some of the shortcomings or frustrations with the kind of food bank concept are starting to encourage some communities to think beyond them. And I want to come back to that in a moment. But I was personally shocked, as part of doing this podcast, to learn that a lot of food banks actually don't even make use of food waste. That they only buy food, which it seems so illogical to me, given the amount of perfectly good food that is thrown away on a daily basis. I mean, as a relatively new food researcher, again, every day I am still in shock at the amount of food that is thrown away, and my brain, in its own kind of autistic way, is always going through scenarios in which that food could be effectively redistributed. I mean, I was, when I was younger, more familiar and slightly connected to groups like Food Not Bombs, which were kind of very much food justice groups. And there are some Food Not Bombs still active in North America today. But what are some post food bank scenarios? What are some kind of radical, and let's do this in the context of if resources were not an issue, what are some scenarios or what are some concepts that could, to your point about allocating all that goodwill, allocating all that volunteer labor, what are some of the ways in which we could channel that, if we had both the resources and the political culture slash will to make it happen? And I'll elaborate on that in a bit, but I'm curious to spend some moments brainstorming on what some of these alternatives could look like.
Could I back up just a bit before we get
Please.
to that question? And because I wanted to talk a bit about food waste. One of the things that is seared in my brain when I first moved to Toronto in the 90s, and I remember talking to the head of the Daily Bread Food Bank at the time. Her first name is Sue, and I've lost her last name, but she talked about getting 2 tractor trailer loads of almost of oranges that were half rotting, and I wasn't there, but she had to kind of mobilize an army of volunteers to go through 2 tractor loads of oranges to sort out the ones that were rotting from the ones that were still usable and get that fruit out to people as quickly as possible. And I've never kind of forgotten, even though I wasn't there, like I imagine the smell. And I think probably most of us have had that experience of putting our fingers into an orange in the grocery store that's moldy and starting to rot. And I just like, oh, oh, I mean, she told me that story 30 years ago, and I've never forgotten it.
If I might digress just to around your point, a lot of it has to do with packaging. So think oranges, onions, other produce, where if one of them in the bag starts to go, they throw the whole bag out. Apples is another, limes, lemons. And the amount of them that they are throwing out every day because 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 15 is rotten, and there's no process to recover all the other good ones. That volume alone is unbelievable. Sorry, go ahead.
For sure. And it's also built into the system, right? Because partly, like you talk about packaging, And also the way that food is, transported across vast distances. So it's actually the idea that, that there's going to be food waste is like it's built into the quote unquote manufacturing of the food that we eat, or like the oranges, the fresh produce, and so on, but also all the other perishable items. It's just assumed that, at more than half of it is going to be food waste. So yeah, it again it kind of it points to one of these like devastating critical
And
weaknesses in the food system.
to circle back to my question, I feel that there are a bunch of converging trends, one of which is transparency, that we are in an increasingly surveilled world, and even those who are engaging the surveillance no longer control the ability to surveil. Which is to say, random people are going into grocery stores and sharing prices to other people, causing a growing literacy of this stuff. And I think there is going to be a growing literacy of just how much food is wasted and the way in which that food could be diverted. And I correlate this to what I see growing radical sentiment amongst young people who are facing this poly crisis and going, what the hell are we supposed to do? So that brings me back to my question of what are some of the alternatives that we could be floating to people when it comes to either dealing with hunger or dealing with how we distribute food or dealing with the ways in which we recognize the labor that goes into food? I have to imagine, as a politically engaged person, you've either thought about this stuff or heard other smart people talk about this stuff. So I'm curious, as we start to approach the end of the episode, that we give people maybe not a sense of hope, that might be a tall order, but a sense of fire as to there being other ways to do things.
I mean, some might be radical, some might be less radical. Like, I think we could start by reintroducing what we used to call home economics into the school curriculum, so that people actually, we maybe don't want to call it home economics, but just so that, people have a sense of confidence in their skills to actually create food for themselves. Maybe we want to incorporate, growing food into the school curriculums as well, so that people again have more of a sense of like maybe we, the schools, of course, are all everything's awash in AI at this moment, but maybe the way to counter that is to return to some really like some practical skills that we need to survive on the planet. So I don't know. Some people might think that's more radical than other people. Does feel like, but that feels like a place to start. I love the idea. I mean, I don't waste a lot of food because I do cook a lot of my own food. But given that if we're going to stay in the current system, at least I think we could take some of that food and maybe instead of maybe one of the things we could do is a food not bombs kind of idea, where that food waste is cooked or somehow redistributed, but not just for, a small group, not small proportion of stigmatized activity like a food bank, but actually as like food not bombs they set up in parks or public spaces where anybody can come along and have some food. I've been involved in some work and some research on food insecurity on campus, including even at Queen's University, which most people would not imagine would ever happen. And some of the people that I did that research with, we talked a lot about, having quote unquote a soup kitchen, but again, a place where students could gather with and make soup. And then distribute it for, people can pay what you can, soup and bread. In my idea of a university that actually cared about or any institution for that matter that actually cared about the people, you'd have kind of have a soup pot in every corner with some fresh fruit and some bread, and it could be really simple, and anybody can help themselves at any point. I had the principal of Queens at the time say, "Well, how do we destigmatize the food bank?" It's like, well, you put it in a public place and you allow anybody to come and get the food, whatever they want, like
Yeah.
no questions asked. Like anybody can just come. You put it in a public place. You don't make it. You don't hide it away. You make it the kind of normal part of. But it's not really about the food bank. It's about having food freely available for everybody. Everybody, from the people who are cleaning the buildings to the head of the place, so that there's again kind of recreating a sense of community and communal eating that
Well,
doesn't
and
depend on your ability to pay.
treating food as a kind of luxury is something I think we currently do, but we don't acknowledge. And what you're describing is treating food not just in the context of abundance, but treating it as if it is life, as if it is something that is inherently accessible. Because what I was imagining while you were describing that is some of the posh conferences and events I've been at, where you're there with all these really important people, and there's great food everywhere. And when I was younger, I used to kind of describe my religion as being the free lunch, that I would go to all these policy events and go to all these academic events because they'd have free lunches and I'd be able to get all this great food. Imagine if we could do that at a community level, at a society level, where there were just places you knew you could go, anyone could go, and there'd be great food. To me, that's not radical. That is common sense. I'm curious, to what extent, as a teacher, as someone who engages with young people, and of course, as we age, it's easy to disparage young people, and our current society is certainly doing its best to try to disparage young people from all sides. I suspect you do not have that view, and at the same time, I'm curious to get your sense of where the young people are at. Am I right in thinking that they're open to radical ideas, itching for something different? Or is that me projecting and wishing that young people were the way I was when I was young?
Yeah, I would say, because I'm at Queen's, we don't have a particularly radical student body at Queen's necessarily, but one of the things that I find quite delightful after the food system course that I've been talking about at the second year course, there's students from all different levels taking it, but I've had several students write to me after the course. I had one in particular who sent me, photos. The course inspires students to grow some of their own food. And so there's some that I've kept in touch with who continued to grow, some of their own food. I think if nothing else, it gives them a sense of appreciation for the work, and the struggle and the riskiness, whether the rabbits eat the lettuce or, the frost kills tomato plants or whatever. And also, some of the students said this year, "Oh, I look forward to seeing you at the farmers market in the summer," So I think it does help them. And they, if nothing else, they don't take for granted anymore the things that they buy at the grocery store. They have a little more awareness of the labor and the work, and also the environmental impact potentially. So who knows where that goes? It's a bit like, I feel a bit like I'm a dandelion plant, kind of spreading seeds. And who knows where those seeds land and how long they might take to sprout. But yeah, I mean, when I first came to Queens a long, long time ago in the early part of this century, I was really struck by, at the time, the kind of resources that the students have. They're not all the, I mean, there's food insecurity on campus, but they generally have a lot of resources, not just economic, but cultural and social. They end up with their degree from Queen's. They go on to do amazing things, and so it's been a real privilege. I'm about to retire, but it's really been an incredible privilege, to spread some of those seeds, whether it's about social determinants of health or about the food system. When I look at the students, at certainly at the best students, I do feel hopeful, actually.
Well, and the model of the dandelion as revolutionary certainly holds well for the future success of the revolution, given how dandelions are quite resilient and the scourge of many people who seek monoculture. As we kind of come to a close, one of the questions I always like to, offer at the end is, is there anything that we haven't touched upon that you would like to touch upon before we end? And I say this more as an invitation, less as a lament, in that, we have covered quite a bit of ground, but that suggests that maybe there's some big 800-pound gorilla in the corner that we should be addressing before we conclude.
Well, I did mention it, but I've be as I say, I've become an advocate for basic income, and I feel like I have a hammer and everything. Basic income is the answer to almost everything, not on its own, but I do think it would. The National Farmers Union, for example, has at their convention in the fall passed a resolution supporting a basic income, I think, of $50,000 a year for farmers, and especially the average age of farmers is approaching 60. It might be 60 by now, and so to support young, that's not going to address the cost of land, but it will provide kind of a foundation for young farmers, a financial foundation to enable them to survive all the ups and downs of, the frost we had this morning here in Kingston in the middle of May. The vagaries of farming, which is, it's really risky. I really have so much respect and admiration for people who are growing food for other people. So it would provide an income floor for young, particularly young farmers, for and especially marginalized people from marginalized groups, whether in farming, whether that's women or racialized groups, people who want to create a different kind of world and a world that's more just and that it obviously is more sustainable. And of course, it would. I mean, it's often thought. Basic income's often thought about as in relation to poverty. It would create again an income floor. And if it were a livable basic income, it would enable people to afford food and to be able to make different choices about the food that they eat. It could support people who want to do food processing, for example, or like start small businesses on kind of food entrepreneurs. So it would make a huge difference, I think, in the food system from production and consumption perspectives. I honestly think it's too threatening right now, for especially for you think about the low wage employers, including the fast food companies and the Amazons and all the rest, who depend on a workforce that's desperate to make some money. And maybe that's where AI is going to push us, quote unquote, over the
Well,
edge. It could push us over so many edges. But
let me jump in right there, only because, AI is my domain of expertise. And this is where I would argue that the narrative around AI and unemployment is entirely made up. And the reality is what you described, that the employment crisis is about greed and an unwillingness to pay people a decent wage, let alone give them a meaningful job. Like working at an Amazon warehouse is demoralizing and dehumanizing on so many levels that we're kind of using AI as this, you know, oh, that's what's disrupting the employment. That's what's disrupting the marketplace. When in fact it's corporate practices. It's terrible wages. And more people are saying, no way, I ain't gonna do that. And that is why they are having difficulties. As another aside, before I became a farmer, one of the reasons I decided to get into farming was I met a farmer who said, we don't really have to worry about the cities flooding from climate change. We will all die way before that because of a bad frost in late May or early June. And it was that kind of insight into the brittle nature of our systems that made me think, I want to be at the front line of this change, so at least I have a little more agency. But to that point of agency, after I've allowed those digressions of myself, what are some of the strategies or tactics that either you've thought about or that people in the larger policy space have thought about when it comes to advancing a kind of universal income or a basic income? Because on the one hand, I do think we have to acknowledge a lot of gains have been made. Like we're having this conversation and it's no longer that radical an idea. But I think you rightfully pointed out it does threaten a lot of the power holders, the stakeholders of our economy. So what's the path forward? What are some of the ideas to really get this policy concept closer to implementation?
You know, as a social scientist, I've spent a lot of my career thinking that if we only have the evidence, you know, we have a good evidence base and a strong evidence base that, you know, that's going to change policy. And I've given up on that. That was a very naive idea of politics. So, I mean, in the basic income movement, I've often said, you know, we need our Tommy Douglas. Like we actually need someone who's willing to carry the torch and to at a probably at a federal, well, it could happen provincially. I mean, we often compare ourselves to Medicare. You know, Tommy Douglas implemented Medicare in Saskatchewan. It was, you know, kind of took root there before it rolled out across the country. But it really did take, I mean, there were lots of other factors, but it took a champion. You know, there's actually been a proposal to that's been costed for implementing a basic income in Prince Edward Island, which would be ideal because it's relatively small, lots of agriculture and kind of seasonal employment. Unlikely that a lot of people are going to uproot themselves and move to PEI, so they could be part of a, you know, 5 or 7 year pilot on basic income, but it could work. We could work out the kinks and figure out how it fits or doesn't fit with some of the other systems that we need, like you know, pharmacare and dental care and all the rest. So that proposal's been, it's actually, it's a group of retired politicians and civil servants and economists have worked on that. It's there now. It's ready to go. It just needs federal funding.
Let me follow up on that. And I kind of feel that we are getting a little off track, and I do have to end the episode soon. But what about Cape Breton? Like what, because and I kind of wanted to bring up Cape Breton in terms of, you know, your own personal history. And I also kind of wanted to speculate on whether farming on rocks is viable, because I have some ideas as to how it could be. But could the scenario you just described with PEI be applied to Cape Breton, but also in the context of migration, that this would be a way to attract people to move to Cape Breton as a potential reversal of the demographics there? Or am I being ludicrous?
No, I don't think you're being ludicrous at all. I mean, there is some good farmland in Cape Breton. And there was a little mini wave of migration during COVID, to Cape Breton and other parts of Nova Scotia. There's also, because the university in Sydney did at one point kind of throw open the doors to international students, there's a big population of people from India now who are living, who've chosen to live permanently, and in Cape Breton. So I think that's a grand idea myself. Of course, it would depend on the provincial government, but then there's always the Cape Breton Liberation Army that wants to separate from the mainland and set up our own government and so on.
You've heard it here on the Future Herd podcast first. Right on.
I don't know if that answered your question, Jesse, but I may or may not retire to Cape Breton when or Nova Scotia at some point, but if I do, part of it will be to work on basic income for Nova Scotia. And I think the Atlantic provinces in general are strong supporters, but again, there isn't really that kind of champion like Tommy Douglas to really push it forward.
Right on. Well, and coincidentally, I do have the head of the PEI Federation of Agriculture booked as a guest. So I will bring up the subject of basic income in PEI to at least see if he's thought about it, if not nudge him along the path. Our last
That's great.
question,
I love that.
the last question I throw out as part of every episode is the shout out. Who are the people that you look up to, or that inspire you, or that nurture your curiosity that you think the rest of us should be paying attention? Like the first question, this is meant to be intuitive. It's not like an Academy Award thank you list, like just a couple of names of who first comes to mind that you want to kind of pass things forward to.
Oh, wow. I love that question. One of the people who's been really important for me because of her work on food insecurity is Val Tarasuk at the University of Toronto, recently retired. I mean, she's kind of dedicated her life to providing a really solid evidence base on food insecurity. Some of the folks in the Canadian Food Studies community, Mustapha Cock, Charles Levko, they're we might not agree on every point in thinking about food justice or the food system or food insecurity, but I just really love them as people. Jennifer Welsh is someone else who's she's retired from what's now TMU, who's had a big influence on me. Heather McLean, who did more kind of women's health kinds of things. She was one of the people who introduced me to qualitative research, which, I had a background in quantitative work, and qualitative work just like spoke to my heart, and that's where I've spent most of my career. Joan
And
Guiseau in the United States. Died recently. She was way ahead of her time in terms of thinking about food.
right on.
What were you gonna say?
Well, I was just going to say this is where inevitably the guest starts to feel a moral responsibility to continue to dig deeper and deeper for the names
Yes.
that they don't want to leave out in case anyone's listening. And that's where I have to
Exactly.
absolve you. I have to absolve you from that and say it's really meant to be. This isn't comprehensive. This is intuitive. And I have to thank you, Elaine. This has been a fantastic conversation that certainly allows me to fully deepen the subjects and the analysis that we're trying to do here on the Future Herd. I've got this current a flippant saying that I keep throwing out, which is that we are currently in a society where we have no thoughtful policy. And the reason we don't have any thoughtful policy is not because people are not putting thought into the policy they're proposing, but because there is not diverse thought in the policies that are being proposed. I will say that doesn't apply to basic income. I actually think there is a lot of diverse thought being put into basic income. But it gets back to my insight around agri-food, where agri is the right wing and food is the left wing. And part of what I want to achieve in the future, Herd, is at least create the opportunity for some thoughtful policy, because for sure the industry right now has the reins of policy. And I'm trying to make an argument that if they want their policy to actually work and be effective, they have to start inviting more people to the policy table. So I thank you, Elaine, for helping to make that argument today by providing a perspective that absolutely needs to be part of the larger discourse. But I end by saying what I've said to a lot of others. I hope we can have you back. I hope that you can be part of the future.
Thank you.
And really help us shape our response to what I think is an escalating crisis that you so eloquently articulated in the first answer. So thanks again.
Well, thank you. I mean, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about the things that are I care so much about. And I don't think I rant it too much. So thanks again for the opportunity.
That was the brilliance. You didn't rant at all. Like, did you indict our current food system as being unjust, tyrannical, and inefficient? Absolutely. Did you do it in the form of a rant? Not at all. It was quite reasonable.
Oh, well, thank you. Excellent. Thank you. I guess that's a good thing.
That was by far one of the most enjoyable conversations I've had as part of this podcast. And quite frankly, almost every single conversation I've had on this podcast is enjoyable. Perhaps my stoner mind has a short-term memory bias here, that it always feels like the last conversation was the best conversation. But this really was one that sat with me for a while, and maybe that's why I didn't release it right away. And I'm happy to say that there have been other conversations that built upon this one that I have since had but not yet released. So I kind of feel that we're at a pivotal point here with the Future Herd. We're, you know, starting to catch a bit of momentum as a herd as we're moving. Some of the technology episodes, some of the leadership knowledge episodes, and now some of the research and critical studies episodes are really starting to weave a picture of the Canadian agri-food sector that I think is unique, that I don't think you can find anywhere else. You know, people have their specialties, they have their domains, their areas of expertise, but I suspect only at the Future Herd are we getting the kind of critical perspective that people like Elaine Power bring. I don't know what that means for the future of the Future Herd, but I do know that we are going to be taking this herd into unprecedented and exciting and interesting and stimulating territory. So if you got any feedback that you want to share with us, please check out our website. There's a link there with our email address. Of course, you can see information about all the episodes we have, the knowledge we're generating, and quite frankly, the research that we're engaged in. I'm recording this on June 18th. And as an aside, I just got into the Cohere Labs Discord server today. Cohere is kind of the Canadian AI champion, and their labs, their open lab, is kind of a place for open science, researchers using AI throughout society around the world. And what's great is I can say, hey, I'm from the Future Herd. I'm a food researcher. I'm a farmer. I want to see how we can use AI. And I can point to the podcast as a public example of the research we're doing. So it was kind of a proud moment to be able to say that we are building something here, something public, something accessible, something interesting, and something we hope to drive change within the Canadian agri-food sector. So more on this in the weeks and days to come. again, you can find us at thefutureheard.ca and let us know what you think, whether you like it, whether you don't, whether there's other people you think we should be talking to. All right, until next time.